Hey, it's Dr. Mike T. Nelson here again with a new episode of the Flex Diet Podcast. Today I have my good friend, Dr. He just graduated a few weeks ago, Adam Feit of Precision Nutrition. And we talk all about the PhD process. If you have any desire to go back and do continuing ed, we get into at the end about Adam's research and more of the psychology end of being a strength coach and a personal trainer. We took all sorts of crazy tangents related to everything from DOMS, delayed onset muscle soreness, to the nervous system, to RPR, reflexive performance reset, and kind of covered a good variety of topics in this episode. So I think you'll really enjoy it. I always love talking to Adam. I've known him for quite a while now and just an awesome dude with amazing information all the time. He'll be coming out with even more information now that he has graduated. So make sure to look out for his stuff in the future. Of course, we are sponsored by the Flex Diet Certification. Go to www.flexdiet.com, FlexDiet, and get on the wait list. You'll be able to get notified as soon as the certification opens up again. The Flex Diet is a mashup of metabolic flexibility plus flexible dieting. And we have 8 interventions related to protein, fats, carbohydrates, fasting. There's even some stuff in there on keto, sleep, exercise, NEAT, micronutrition. And within each one of those, there's an ongoing video of the big picture so that you understand the context of the concepts of both metabolic flexibility and flexible dieting. And then there's a 1-hour technical video on each topic. So everything you wanted to know about, say, carbohydrates and how they apply to coaching people through nutrition and performance, narrowed down to just over an hour. We've got all the references and everything for you. And we even have great interviews from people like Dr. Stu Phillips, Dr. Eric Helms talking all about flexible dieting approach, Dr. Dan Party, Dr. Mike Ormsby talking about protein feedings at night and glucose regulation, and a bunch of other key expert interviews. So go to flexdiet.com, sign up to the wait list. It'll open again around January 2021. Enjoy this conversation with my good buddy, Dr. Adam Feit. What's going on? It's Dr. Mike T. Nelson here on the Flex Diet Podcast. I'm here with now Dr. Adam Feit. How are you, sir?
Pretty awesome, Dr. Mike T. Nelson.
It's like the, feels good to the be old Fletch movie, great doctor, doctor, doctor.
Definitely surreal. I think this might be my second podcast or just discussion with somebody other than my wife and kids that since defending. So still trying it on, see how it feels, you know, but I'm going to use it as much as I can until somebody like you tells me, all right, that's enough. We all understand.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember going through the process, a guy I worked with at the time, he's like, oh, so when you graduate, does everyone call you doctor? And I'm like, no, most people I know just don't give a shit. Which is totally fine, you know?
Yeah. My wife, she actually, not many people, well, I guess some depending on what circles you're in, but my wife and I decided to go back at the same time for our PhD.
So that's
she
right.
In teaching, and I did mine in sports psych. And so she actually got done a little bit earlier than me in April. And I was like, you know, all right, tell me about it, you know, like what's changed? And she's like, nothing. Like nothing. It's like living with your boyfriend and then you get married. Like nothing changes. Oh no, it'll be completely different when I graduate. And then, yeah, sure enough, I woke up. Actually, I defended in the afternoon and it was like, okay, laundry's still got to get done. Dinner's got to be on the table and my daughter's got dance. So see you guys later.
Yeah. I think it's different maybe when you're a little bit older. Cause I remember I was so nervous for my defense because you know, you're just like, oh, you put all this time and effort into it. And, you know, hopefully they wouldn't set you up to fail. Normally you'll kind of fail out of the process before you get to that, or they just don't let you do it. And I had been shot down a whole bunch of times before I got to my defense. So I was hoping that I was going to make it and, you know, had a couple of people there. And afterwards, everyone's like, oh, did you go out and have some rager of a party or whatever. I'm like, no, it was at like 11 in the morning. We got done and walked across the street of the U of M campus, went to Buffalo Wild Wings. I had a beer and my wife drove me home and we chilled out at night and I went to bed. You know, it was just more just a sense of relief more than anything else of like, oh, thank God that's over.
Yeah, I will say that. I mean, just in terms of stress, you talk about this all the time, but when it comes from any dimension or domain, like your body's really not going to recognize it. It's just like overload. So I think, yeah, I got done in the afternoon. I think we ordered a pizza. We watched a movie on Netflix and I was out
like, yeah.
that night because like you said, I'm curious to know your process, but for us at Springfield College, we had to take a written comps exam at the end of our second year for 6 hours. Then after that, we had to take a research exam comps for 6 hours. And then we had orals for content for 2 hours. And that's all to be just a candidate. And then you apply for your dissertation and whatnot. And so that was another 2 hour defense after the whole paper. So, you know, all in all, it was like 16 hours of just getting drilled by the firing squad accordingly.
Yeah, they switched ours. We had just to officially be a PhD candidate after you've applied and everything. It used to be where you had to take some heinous all day exam or whatever. And I was super nervous about it, but I'm like, okay, at least on this day, you know, June 1st of this year, it'll be done, you know? And I'm like, I'm just so looking forward to that. And literally like right before I go in, they're like, oh yeah, we switched it to a take-home exam. I'm like, what do you mean a take-home exam? It's like, well, we've got four people on your committee, including your advisor. So they each get to submit a question. They'll each grade the question and you have 30 days to do it. So at face value to most people, when you describe that, you're like, well, that doesn't sound as bad. I'm like, No, it's so bad because you're literally expected to write like a mini dissertation within 30 days. And I didn't know this because they had changed it right before. So idiot me didn't plan 30 days after of like learning my schedule of like everything else. So I remember traveling with my wife to visit her family. I still had to work. I still had everything going on. And it was so bad. And, you know, I think a lot of times they just like to dick with you in the process. So I get the grades back and it was basically like you get one appeal. So I didn't pass the first time. And two of the people passed me, two of the people didn't. So then I had to go in and take their comments and rework them, submit it again one last time. And if they said it wasn't good enough, then you just literally like flush out of the whole program, which when I took it was 3.5 years into the program.
Yeah.
You know, because people forget that it's too. You've invested like many years of your life already by that point. So,
yeah, I think that's they actually changed it towards the end of my last year. So now they have you do the content stuff after year one to effectively, I mean, you don't want to say it, but it's to weed them out.
Yeah, exactly. Totally.
You have to like us. Yeah. You put in 2-3 years of work and then it was the same thing. You could fail it once at an exam once. You couldn't retake it until the following year. Mm. So it sets you back automatically. And I had some colleagues do that, but if you fail it twice, you know, hey, see you later. Nice
bye
knowing
bye.
You. And that happened to a few people in my wife's program, in the teaching administration program. And just, you know, for us, it was a lot of the statistics because, you know, we were a teaching college and depending on – we took a lot more research classes than probably some other programs that aren't heavily involved. And that's a curveball for a lot of us, including myself. So,
yeah, I had to suffer through a whole year of biostatistics. And this is after I had transferred in and had a minor in mathematics and stuff. But – for engineering, you don't take a lot of statistics. I mean, you do the standard manufacturing type stuff, but you know, when you're dealing with biological systems, that's like its own branch of statistics. And I was so excited after I finally, that was like one of my last classes that I had to complete. And I think I was more excited about completing the classwork almost than I was about passing the exams, just because I was not a good test taker. And, you know, like for most people listening, like you have to get at least a B or above average or you lose funding, you get kicked out of the program. So you can't just kind of slack off. So I remember passing that class going, oh, thank God, this is the last academic class I ever have to take for a grade. And that was a good feeling.
That was a great feeling. I think for us, we had to do outside of dissertation credits. I think our program had 74 credits of classwork.
Ooh, that's a lot.
Yeah, or maybe it was 76. But I know the dissertation itself was like about 14 to 16 credits. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I mean, I was taking 9, 12 semester hours, like 3-4 classes, like I was an undergrad again.
Yeah,
while working full time for precision nutrition, volunteering at the college for my internship hours, you know, for sports psych, and, you know, trying to be a halfway decent dad and husband. So, yeah, when the pandemic hit, unfortunately, there was, I guess, a little bit of a relief of like, okay, I don't have to continue to commute to campus. Like I can do this from Zoom, like I'm familiar with it, et cetera. So in some ways, there were definitely more silver linings, I think, in my lifestyle and my academic coursework than others, because it allowed me to kind of anchor down and really finish strong accordingly.
And I'm assuming you probably had your data collection, I would assume, done by that point, correct?
Ooh, I wish I did. So
because I know a lot of people's studies, they just got blown up. Like I knew some people in grad school that they were in their fourth year of a PhD program, were just finishing data collection. And I mean, it's like, what do you do? You know, I know people that had studies that they had spent, you know, 3 years working on, 4 years working on, and can't finish data collection. You know, you're just like, oh my God.
and we're still there. Yeah. A guy I went to school with, same thing. He had gone to proposal, like ready to go. So this was the beginning of second semester last year. And I actually got to proposal a couple days before our spring break. And then we ended up shutting down after spring break. So I got in right at the nick of time.
Yeah.
And because I was doing interviews remotely through Zoom, I was able to kind of get through IRB with no problems. But yeah, we had a bunch of master students. You know, my wife's the associate director of strength conditioning, and we still got grad students that want, you know, need to collect data, and they're doing awesome things. You know, the effect of fasting on strength and power, and, you know, trying to take blood and whatnot. And they're like, yeah, we can't do that yet. So I think that's going to be a struggle. I think, you know, hey, I feel if there's any students out there, like I feel for you, and hopefully this gets sorted out sooner than later.
Yeah, I just think we'll look back at probably 2 to 5 years from now, and if you look at just research across many disciplines, I think you're going to see this little divot and a drop and a little asterisk of just all the stuff that just kind of got hosed in the process.
Yeah, I will say, I mean, I had to put that as a limitation, right? You know, what was holding me back? It was like, hey, I did this during a worldwide pandemic, and maybe some of the answers that I got from the participants weren't truly reflective because they hadn't coached in a couple weeks, but don't hold that against me. You know, let's get this thing published someday, and we're going to be all right. So,
yeah. And that's the hard part, even as a reviewer and stuff too. It's like I always give sort of the benefit of doubt to the person doing the study, unless there's just a methodological error that's clear as day where you're just like, the whole thing's effed, you know,
but so you're not reviewer three. That's what you're telling me.
You are
human.
Yeah. I've been on the other end of the spectrum on that too. Yeah. And it's hard because like everybody wants quote unquote perfect data collection and everything, but there's also the reality of it. You're collecting data in the real world if you're doing some external validation type study, and it's not going to be perfect. It's going to be kind of messy. You're going to do the best you can with, you know, the number of people you have and the power and the statistics and all that kind of stuff. But it drives me insane when more armchair online critics are like pointing to flaws in the study. And I'm like, did you email the researcher? I could almost guarantee that they probably thought of that, you know, because I just said in energy drinks and we ended up using ride to fatigue as one of our markers. And they're like, oh, but why didn't you do a time trial? This doesn't relate to sports performance. And I'm like, you know what? I actually had it written that way. I changed it because we could only get recreational level athletes. So if I get someone who's like really good on a bike, who rides a lot, and someone who rides twice a week, and I show that there's a learning effect now in the order of the trial that's done, and I don't do enough familiarization trials, etc., the whole study is screwed. Yeah. You know, and then you're relying on volunteers, so I probably got to add 2 familiarization trials, plus the 3 times that they're coming into the lab. So now that's 5 times they have to come into the lab, you know, for free and get poked and prodded and tube stuff in their mouth and all that kind of stuff too. So it's, yeah, there's always going to be limits. You do one thing, you can't do the other thing then.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I love how you bring it up. It's interesting we're taking the angle that we are, but just kind of, you know, what chaps me as a coach, right, as a practitioner, is once I started to learn, it was, and I've seen those critics, right? We see the trolls online, like I get the emails and I'm watching, you know, your Facebook posts. And it's like the higher control that we have in the study, the less applicability it is going to be in the real world, right?
Correct.
We're naturally balancing out internal and external validity. So
right.
I laugh, like I hysterically sit back and sit in my chair and look at these posts on Facebook and Instagram and whatnot. And people are, I mean, throwing arms up of like, what are we thinking? How is that going to be appropriate? And it's like, you have no idea, because again, they're not in that process of the compromises you have to make. And largely in part, you know, some of it isn't really your choice. It's your committee. And it's like, they've got stuff to do and they want to make sure you graduate. And so, you know, there's obviously some ethical concerns there with research like anything else. But yeah, you want a completely buttoned up, like white, labeled perfect study, gold standard, it's going to come at a sacrifice. But obviously, it depends on what you're trying to look at, right?
Yeah. And even some of the people, like years ago when Kevin Hall was doing some studies in a metabolic chamber, people are like, oh my God, how does he dare do that? That's not real world. No one does that. No one has all their food perfectly calibrated in this. I'm like, exactly. Like, do you have a metabolic chamber? Like, you're going to run a study that costs, you know, a couple $1 million, and it's not set up for external validity. It's trying to figure out what is the underlying mechanism of some of these things. And we are purposely trying to hold everything, you know, as tight as a gnat's ass to try to figure that out. We're not trying to do this to tell you, okay, with your real world online coaching, here's what you should do. You know, so then it just kind of goes back to, what is the mechanism? What are you trying to show by the study? And, you know, it takes a collection of studies, both internal and external validation, and it's a consensus all the time. So anyway,
yeah, sorry, well, my pet setting it up for the long picture. This is good. We're just like airing out our grievances
about
the higher ed academic process and bridging the gap between right theory and application. We're gonna face battles everywhere we go, so do the best we can with what we have, right?
I feel like it's when you watch Seinfeld, December 23rd, that's like the airing of grievances for the holiday celebration they had with the steel pole and the feats of strength for Festivus.
Festivus for the rest of us.
Yeah. It's so sad. Like, I bring up Seinfeld references now and students are like, what are you talking about? I'm like, what?
Seinfeld, I bring up Anchorman references. I mean, and that, you talk about more modern. I was in San Diego coaching at the Olympic Training Center the summer it came out, and I was, you know, I was turning 21. I'm like, this is glorious, right? Like, I mean, every other coaching cue was a one-liner from the movie.
Yeah.
And so I bring up, you know, little things like that, and they're like, no, never seen it. And I'm like, wow, like you are doing humanity and coaching a disservice right now.
Yeah, I did the RPR level 3 cert, and Cal Dietz had one of his interns there, and so she was a super nice girl, but the two presenters were just giving her a hard time, because you sometimes forget like how young people are who are entering coaching, and even students. So the running joke the whole weekend was like all these old classic movies where we were just quizzing her the whole time if she had seen them or not. So we're making her like top 12 list of movies she had to go back and watch.
Let that stand for the record, young coaches and scientists. You need somebody like that in your corner, because there are a lot of valuable life lessons that these shows and movies can show you about life. So
yeah,
glad you're able to be there for her with you and Cal. So
yeah,
that's great that you did the level 3. I was actually just on the phone with JL this past weekend.
Nice.
Catching up. So we got our grad students at Springfield hooked up with RPR level 1.
Cool.
And Got a couple continuing ed programs in line for the winter break. So we're excited to, you know, kind of bring that more towards the forefront and get, you know, younger coaches better, so to speak. So,
yeah. And you did the level 1, if I remember correctly.
Correct. Yeah, I don't even know what it would be called right now. I remember because Cal had come out when I was running the gym in New Jersey, ripped. And
it was like one of the super early ones, I think, wasn't it?
So I technically have, you'd have to clarify this for me, but technically my certificate is like level 2 as well.
Yeah, because you did them both.
We went through
all
the drivers. I mean, we went through everything.
Yeah.
And it was very hands on. So I do have level 2 before it was like level 2.
Nice. Yeah. And if you have Cal as the instructor, I went to the early ones because I learned through Douglas Heal through Be Activated, which RPR got a license to teach his stuff. And I remember sitting in one of the first ones that Cal taught publicly in the Twin Cities. And it was about like 2 in the afternoon. He was only doing level 1 that day, and he was supposed to do level 2 the next day. And he's just, you know, ripping through stuff, and he's like showing everyone how to do all this stuff. And everyone's like, oh, yeah, great. It's like 2 p.m. He's like, all right, well, I think that's it for level one. Any questions? And I look around and everyone is just like deer in the headlights of a Peterbilt. They have like no idea what just happened. So I'm raising my hand and I ask a bunch of questions. And then people felt like it was okay to actually ask questions that they didn't really understand, you know, some stuff. And I love Cal. He's awesome. But he's done it like so much. Like if you sometimes don't interrupt him with a question, then it's just like, everyone's got it. Cool. All right. Next thing. Oh, you got to see this next thing. It's super cool. And
yeah, I remember that. We had about maybe 40 or 50 people at our place when he came out and did the same thing, came out for the weekend. And it was awesome. And we had the gym, you know, we were partnering up with a physical therapy clinic as well. So we brought out like 8-10 tables and, you know, we're all doing the stuff on each other, trying to figure it out. And but like exactly like you said, right, it becomes almost a second language where you're just assuming, you know, you don't realize how much you know, because you're probably in a different room. Well, now you're in this room and you're like, whoa, hold on, we have to slow things down a bit. So it's been great to see how everything has changed and really evolved into, you know, especially with the online stuff and working through that and, you know, with the colors and the vision work. And I'm excited to dive deep a little bit more into it as things evolve accordingly.
Yeah, it's one of those things. And obviously, I'm biased because I teach for RPR. And even back to the science thing, people are like, well, what's the exact science of it? I'm like, I don't know. I mean, I can tell you some stuff I think that's going on. There's like been 2-3 studies that's ever really been done on it. But again, you hate to say that in my experience or anecdotal only, it's like I've tested a lot of other systems and I don't know, man, it just seems to work. And I've translated that even to online stuff. And I don't even tell people what it is. I'm like, yeah, just do these drills. I know it looks batshit crazy. I know it looks insane. And like generally the feedback is very similar each time. So it's, yeah, I think that's always hard when you're like yourself, you're obviously done a lot of work in science and we'll talk about your dissertation coming up. But then you work in the real world also. Mm-hmm. It's like at the end of the day, if a client comes in, they don't care how many studies there is on something. I hope that I know some of the background of it if they ask and I can get them a better result. But if 17 studies say this thing should work and it does or doesn't, all they care about is the N=1 result by the time they walk out the door, you know? So yeah. I think that's always even the debate online too. And it's like, how can you kind of bridge those two together where like the research kind of gives you the general direction and then the research gives you the specific answer on an individual N=1 level too.
Yeah. Well, and I know we talk a lot about it at Precision Nutrition, but I think we've all fallen as a victim or the victor, however you want to look at it, but the trap of like evidence-based, right?
Yes.
So is it evidence-led? Is it evidence-based? But like what truly is evidence-based? Is it simply waiting for that white paper research journal that is, you know, by the time it gets through all the reviewing and it's finally out there, it's probably a little bit outdated. Is it a combination of the coach's intuition and their personal experiences, as well as what the client feels, what they're going through as well? So, you know, it's important to consider all of that in the process, because if we look at all of that research, if we look at all of the things that powerlifters were doing and bodybuilders were doing for years and years and years, yeah, they probably couldn't explain it, but we can't deny that what they were doing, albeit outside the effects of other performance enhancing substances or methods, were working. And so why continue to fight and make a big deal about it? Why don't we work and collaborate and let's validate those methods and help them get the recognition they deserve? I think that's super important to explore.
Yeah, especially if your goal is to get stronger, then it makes sense to look at what do powerlifters and Olympic weightlifters do. If you want to preserve as much muscle mass as possible and get leaner, drugs aside, maybe looking at what bodybuilders do, at least the consensus, that's probably going to give you some pretty good clues to start there. And of course, you always have to be aware of, you know, what is the cost to do that. But as a starting point, it's probably going to give you some pretty good data to look at.
Yeah. And you know this, but just it's never about proving something is working because we can't do that in research.
Yeah.
But going through that process, and I've struggled with this just being a coach over the years of like trying to find the best way or the holy grail of like, you know, oh yeah, I'm going to get this certification or RPR is the ticket, right?
Mm-hmm.
But how can we clear the waters, right? You know, if the water itself is pretty muddy, well, we can probably rule out this technique or we can probably rule out that protocol. That's just as important, if not more important, than trying to validate all the things that are working, because this industry itself is completely saturated with Fitfluencers and protocols and challenges, and it drives a lot of us nuts, I know for a fact. So
Even one of my favorite quotes is from Dr. Pat Davidson, is that it, you know, the scientific process is just like knocking down bowling pins. It's like we're never really proving anything. We're just like, okay, this theory, okay, we kind of disprove that, doesn't appear to be true. This one, okay, we're able to disprove this. And at the end of the day, you're left with, you know, these two, three, four, five theories, and they might be true. I mean, we haven't been able to disprove them so far to date. Doesn't mean that we won't. But if you're not trained in that thought process too, which, you know, took many years to beat into my thick skull, it's hard to explain that to clients, because everybody else in the quote, quote, real world is like, well, what do I do? Like, what is true? Like, what is the correct thing? You know, what is the optimal thing to do? Which drives me batshit crazy. It's like, no, let's just work on something better. Yeah, I don't think that's the best route. We've got some pretty good data to show that that's probably not the thing. But let's go over here and kind of go in that direction, you know. And maybe we don't have as much solid data on that, but hasn't really been disproven yet. So it's probably going to get us closer a little bit better.
Yeah, I love how you bring up the idea of theories, because I remember having a discussion with my advisor. And, you know, in sports psychology, right, the softer science, you're basing your work on a theoretical framework, right? So what is the lens that you're looking at this, and how you're going to answer the research questions? And I just remember going through that whole proposal process and watching other people. And it was like, oh, yours is based in self-determination theory, or yours is, you know, mine was based in self-efficacy theory, or yours is based in that theory and that theory. And I remember reading a paper and talking about it, being like, I think we're spending so much time trying to stay in the lane of all the theories that were established. Like, why aren't we trying to either disprove it or maybe create a new one and lend some evidence towards something else, right? Like, I remember we just hired but at the college hired a new exercise physiology and neuro professor, young guy, did some postdoc work at Harvard, like really sharp guy. And, you know, we're talking through some of the advanced ex-phys stuff. And I remember when it just had come out, I think it was last year, but how they're talking about like DOMS, how maybe it's not the muscle fiber, it's more of a neurological issue.
Right.
And it was like blowing people's mind. And I'm like, this is the stuff that we need to circulate, because you know, the old coaching adage, right? You always do what we've always done. You're always going to get what we've always gotten. And so if we're not pushing the boundaries and exploring the edges, then we're just going to say, oh, this is based in this theory because some guy from the 1970s at a, you know, high or middle class school, primarily filled with, you know, college age resistance training men with, you know, certain levels of privilege, said it worked.
Yeah.
We're not going to get any better.
Yeah. Even with DOMS, I've always wondered too, because if you look at the data, everybody thinks that, okay, if you have DOMS, delayed onset muscle soreness, performance automatically goes down. It's like, oh, bro, my quads hurt really bad, so my performance is just going to be crap. If you look at the data, it's not super clear, right? At some point, if you absolutely completely brutalize and trash a muscle, your force is definitely going to go down. But it doesn't track like this nice one-to-one relationship. And then you throw stuff in like, you know, markers we use for muscle damage all the time, CK, creatine kinase. Yeah, they're associated with DOMS, but they don't track perfectly on a one-to-one linear relationship either. You know, at some level, if you've got a shit ton of CK in your blood, you probably have some DOMS, and you've definitely damaged some muscle, and you probably have impaired force. But in that kind of in-between zone, I don't even know anymore. You said, maybe it's all just a sensitization of the nervous system, because you're going by, unless you're doing a biopsy and looking at, you know, Z-line streaming, stuff like that, you're going by what they report. They're saying, oh, on a VAS, a visual analog scale, it's this. So that's their interpretation of a feeling and a sensation, and that gets even more messy.
and that's I'm glad you brought that up, because looking at it from the other end of coaching mental performance, the perception and the mindset that they bring to that situation is going to give us more information than anything. I remember when I first started coaching, I was working with, you know, Olympians like Toby Stevenson was a silver medalist in the pole vault. This was maybe 2004, but guys like Ian Walt and Jared, the late Jared Rome, I mean, power throwers. And I'm looking at the program and like they are squatting hard and heavy and push pressing hard and heavy. The like within 12, 16 hours of the meet.
Wow.
And I'm like, and you know, and we had, I think, some block country was coming out, and I think he was the bronze medalist in 2004 in the shot. And this guy's like max effort deadlifting like 600-700 pounds for triples, doing the same thing day before the meet. But I'm asking him, I'm like, you come from a traditional coaching model, right? Like no DOMS, like
right.
Slow body, like 48 hours before the big game.
Right.
And he's like, we love to feel tight. Like we love to feel compact, stressing the system so much before it, like we feel better. And I was like, yeah, they didn't teach me that in the textbook. So I'm obviously not going to mess with that. I'm just a slappy intern, but
right.
It seems to be working for you. Right. But that whole perception of how does this feel if you're going to delay in that and sit in that discomfort of like, oh, I'm sore, I can't do anything, I'm not strong. I mean, you're just sitting in that defeating attitude and you're going to perform not well.
Yeah. And then my brain even goes to, I'm like, well, is there something to like having some inflammation and higher, you know, interstitial fluid and pressure to, you know, change the like dynamic movement that we haven't looked at or something? I have no freaking idea, but who knows?
Yeah. Well, that's, I think, the beauty of it, right?
Yeah.
Who does know? If you do know, let us know.
Yeah.
there's a quest for all of us to try and find out and to just move away from the traditional ideologies of, you know, inflammation and then icing everything. And
yeah.
You know, it's funny you bring up Pat Davidson because he had gone to Springfield College as well.
Yes.
When I was leaving my undergrad, and, you know, he's making his mark in the health and fitness world, but just challenging these concepts that we just were blindly following about how we should train and how we should not train and how we should set up programs. So it's important to kind of be that, you know, that go that rogue way or that rebel way and start to look at things from a different perspective, because that's how we are going to advance in this field.
Yeah, yeah, totally. And so tell us more about what you looked at for your PhD dissertation. It's kind of sort of related to these topics a little bit.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate the opportunity to chat a little bit about it. But I had come from a pretty heavy strength conditioning background. I had, you know, dabbled in a lot of different areas and in different levels and whatnot, and had an opportunity to come back, get my PhD alongside my wife, as I said earlier. But I took the sport and exercise psychology route because I had was probably still suffering PTSD from my undergrad ex-fit. Now there's good guys like you to get my information, I'm not, you know, brought back to the, is it the Frank Starling mechanism?
Yeah. Yeah. A little stretch on the cardiac system there.
Yeah. the chalkboard still is just so, in my face about that. But what I was interested in is really evaluating, the gap, right? We talk about like tensions or essentially where we are now and where we could be. And what I saw a lot of was that, let's say strength conditioning coaching or physical performance coaching, high performance enhancement. We have so many different names of like getting people more bigger, faster, stronger, jacked and tan, right? Mm-hmm. That are we neglecting a big piece of their development? And so I looked at, I'll slow it down a little bit. I wanted to know what the use of sports psychology techniques, strategies, skills, essentially mental skills, how are those being used in the field of strength conditioning? So I did a two-part study, put out a survey, which was awesome. The first part was like 1,100 responses. Like, ooh. I was like, let's go.
That's crazy.
Like 10 times the amount that was in current published research. So
wow.
I found a lot of research from Radcliffe, Comfort, and Facette in like the mid-2000s. And I was like, this is great. But I'm like, I've got 10 times that amount. And then I get to the process of like cleaning the data and screening the data.
Oh, God.
And I was like, oh, man, we only got like 600, close to 700. So then I brought it down to college coaches because I spent a lot of time in college and had been at the college. And so I looked at essentially, you know, on a scale of 1 to 7, 1 being very infrequently, 7 being very frequently, how often were you using what you know about sports psychology, these skills and strategies on a regular basis? So, you know, we talk about the use of music, but, you know, what are you using for arousal regulation? What are you using for concentration strategies? How are you using self-confidence, motivation, goal setting, et cetera? And so I got some really great data from that, but like any research, right, you just can't stop with that one research question. And so while I picked up things like, hey, you know, knowledge obviously is a barrier. We're only going to coach, or we're only going to write a program for what we feel competent in. That makes sense, right? I remember when, let's say, kettlebells had come out, and when I said come out, it was like popular in mainstream coaching. If I didn't have any experience with it, I wasn't coaching it. And it was really the same with, you know, elements of sports psychology. So we found things like that. We found that there were no differences between genders. Kind of ran some basic statistical tests to see where we were at. But I was like, all right, now that I have the landscape kind of painted, right, we know goal setting, self-confidence, and motivational strategies are like the top three used by coaches. I want to know exactly what you're doing. Like, I want to get in your face. I want to be at your hip. And I want to be able to say, all right, take me through your day. What elements of mental skills are you using? Why are you using them? What's in your way or whatnot? So I did a follow-up study, interviewed 16 Division I strength conditioning coaches from, I think, four out of the five Power Five schools. I had head coaches. I had football-only coaches. I had Olympic-only coaches. I had males, females. I had coaches that were coaching less than 5 years and coaches that had more than 20 years. So I felt like really good from a sampling strategy of like, I'm really trying to capture as much of collegiate strength conditioning as possible. And so that's what I did. So I looked at, hey, you know, what are you doing specifically? What are the barriers and obstacles in your way? You know, why aren't you doing it the way you thought? Right. Because I was a little biased, right. You know, I'm writing my positionality statement. I'm like, hell yeah, sports psych, like coaching up self-talk and taking some ammonia salts. Like, of course that's going to improve performance. And, you know, I'm guilty of a little Monday motivational video once in a while. And those cheesy one-liners, like, you know, let's go and let's get your chili hot and all that crap. So I wanted to look at that. And I wanted to see, like, what did they know about sports psychology in coaching? You have to get a degree in a related field. So were we following kinesiology? Were we following exercise science? Or did we have some people that had some background in that? So I'll pause in a little bit. But essentially, yeah, I did a deep dive, put together, I think it was 90-minute interviews with coaches. The coding process, for anybody that's still listening and understands the
qualitative study, right?
Oh, man. Oof. That was a slap in the face, like, over and over again. Because you think you've kind of got, like, the answer, and then you go through it again. You're like, no, that's not it. So you're just constantly – I mean, I kid you not. I had transcripts, thousands of pages of transcripts. Well, maybe not thousands. 16 interviews, 50 pages, so hundreds. And I'm coding them, I'm tagging them, I'm highlighting, I'm making little notes, and then I'm cutting them out. And I've got like three bank set in my living room. And I'm like trying to – I mean, it was like a beautiful mind, like Russell Crowe, like all over the place. Because you're trying to make – what is the data telling me and showing me? So, yeah, I went through that process and was able to get buttoned everything up, you know, by the end of the fall. So, so that's where I started. I wanted to know – I wanted to do a deep dive. The role of a coach is very influential. You know, they're doing more than just training, proper strength training and conditioning methods. They're providing emotional support, social support, physical support. And if there's anybody that is going to coach mental skills, the strength conditioning coach can be an ideal person because of the strength of that, you know, athlete coach relationship. I mean, you know this with your M3 clients, like you build great rapport with them. They trust you. They're probably telling you things that you're like, whoa, you know, should this be a counselor or a therapist or whatnot? And so when we look at that, right, there's a gigantic stigma against mental health, mental performance, sports psychology. And that's what I found in the research, right? Some coaches are like, yeah, I don't mess with that. I just, once they start talking about suicide, I defer out. And I'm like, oh, it's not just that. Like, we spend so much time on relative intensities and periodization schemes and advanced, you know, French contrast training reps and sets. Yeah. And it's like missing such a big piece here. So I really wanted to figure out, like, how are you guys, how is everybody doing it? What do you even know about it? Where are you getting your resources from? And what are some of the things in your way? So I'm looking forward to hopefully putting it into the publication journals. I need a little bit of a break, as you can imagine.
Oh, yeah.
But yeah, so we're going to wrap all that up. I'm curious to get some Q&A here, but essentially – sports psychology, how is it, those elements and techniques and skills being used as a coach, and what can we learn about it, in other sectors as well?
Yeah. I mean, I think that's a huge area, especially in the future. For a while, I served on the Mindset Performance Institute. I was just research helping them with more from the, because I got into it backwards. So I started many years ago. First client sat down, and you can imagine that, male, 40 pounds overweight. Look at his food log. No, he's eating a sleeve of Oreos every day. Cool. Don't eat the Oreos. I'm like, man, I'm a great coach. This is awesome. Guy, you can imagine, goes away, comes back again, still eating like a whole sleeve of Oreos, right? And this goes on, because I'm not very bright, for, God, almost like 2 or 3 months. And eventually, I just got so frustrated. I said, fine, don't worry about it. We're not going to do anything. And then I went back and started taking more neurobiology classes, because I'm like, well, maybe I should figure out, like, how does the brain work? Like, I only know a basic thing, like, how does it work? How did, you know, association, neurons, blah, 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 all that stuff. And then I realized, I'm like, oh my God, I'm such an idiot. All I'm telling this poor guy is, like, Oreos, Oreos, Oreos. It's like, don't think of a pink elephant. It's like, you just thought of the pink elephant. So I'm berating this poor bastard about his Oreos, and he's just thinking Oreos, but he's cognitive enough to know that he's not supposed to have the Oreos. So then he eats them, and then he feels bad on top of it. And yeah, I had like 3 clients almost like that, one right after the other. And I remember after like literally half a year in the profession, I'm going, why am I going back to school for exercise physiology? This has nothing to do with physiology. It's almost all psychology. And, you know, now fast forward 16 years later, I think it still does. You know, I think in the future, I'd be curious on your opinion on this, coaches and trainers will have to know sets and reps. You'll have to know your exercise phys. You'll have to know your basic nutrition, like PN, and all those programs I think are awesome. But I think that's going to be the base level. That's going to be the expectation that you have to have these things down cold. The next level is going to be, how do you, you know, do things with like psychology? How do you actually get people to do, to change their behaviors? How do you get them to stay motivated, whatever that is? And that to me is like the next level, and all the skills that I kind of had to pick up along the way, which I'm sure many other trainers have had to.
Yeah. I mean, I'm obviously biased because I work for Precision Nutrition.
Exactly.
And we're in that space, but that's what drove me to get the degree. It wasn't about, you know, hating exercise phys necessarily. And, you know, am I going to remember the rate limiting step of, you know, glycolysis and all of that, but it was about, okay, great. I've had my fair share of struggles. I'm a naturally a bigger guy. I played offensive line. And so getting the meal plans, understanding macros, energy in versus energy out, like as much as we want to deduce it to simple as it's either this or that, there's so many other factors at play. And when you coach as long as we do, you get to understand that, all right, he or she's got the plan, but why aren't they executing it, right? Or they were all gung-ho the first week when I signed up and they paid me, you know, a month in advance. But now what's happening? Right? Why are they ghosting me? Or, you know, how come they're doing this or they're doing that? So, yeah, I would say you're going to have that base level of competence. But you and I both know, right? Like your clients aren't asking you the questions that your university professors and educators said you're going to need to know, right? Like I still laugh at when I visit my wife on campus when classes were still on, you know, sessions, and I'm looking at the lab and, you know, they're measuring the pulse, radial pulse, and they're doing the blood pressure. And it's like, I remember 15 years ago, I'm like, yeah, I'm going to just use a heart rate monitor. And they're like, that's not always going to work, you know? And I'm like, yeah, if it doesn't, I'm going to have an extra.
I'm going to get
like,
another one.
We're not going to do that, right? And now like the metrics and the wearables and all the KPIs we can pull from that is driving how we're coaching that. Yeah. So, you know, like we just finished a course for PN about, you know, we call it change psychology, but using these elements of behavior psychology and the biopsychosocial elements of like, here's why, especially now, right? Here's why your client is gaining weight and they don't want to, or here's why they're stressed to the max. And it's not just about like, hey, bro, like let's do some meditation and drink some bulletproof coffee in the morning and let's call it a day. There are so many things pulling on them. So to answer your question, I'm 100% behind you. The work is being done. I think now more than ever, mainstream fitness and health have to publicize that, have to share that instead of the latest like Instagram giveaway around the holidays about, you know, type in, give me your stats and I can just put in a fancy calculator and give you your macros. That's great. But guess what? They're just going to sit there. And if you don't learn how to coach that, you're not going to get any results.
Yeah. And it's an interesting dichotomy too, because I just got a testimony from a client who graduated And she was like, it's like, wow, you're much more of a life coach than I ever imagined, you know, which I didn't take that as a knock at all. I took that as like, well, that's a huge compliment, you know, because people come in thinking that it's all sets and reps and finding the perfect program. And obviously you have to deliver on that front. But I mean, I can't even think of a single client who's ever come in and been like, you know, man, I know you're going to give me sets and reps and you're going to talk to me about nutrition, but you know, it's really my psychology that needs help. Like, nobody says that, you know, but almost at the end of the day, that's kind of their rate limiter, you know? So it's trying to approach it in a way where it's like the old analogy of people go to the movies to watch whatever the new movie is. I guess maybe not so much now, but you dial it up on your TV, whatever. But back when theaters were in business, but theaters themselves would make more money off of concessions than they would ever on movies. But they wouldn't advertise, hey, come to the theater and get popcorn. It's like, oh, that doesn't make any sense. Why? Mm-hmm. But when I go there, it's like, oh, maybe I'll get a popcorn, maybe I'll get something else, right? So they're still delivering on what they promised. Hey, here's a new movie. But, you know, while you're here, maybe you should think about this thing over here too.
Yeah. I love how you bring up the whole idea with the movie theater. And I was listening to a few of your older podcasts, and you're talking about the, you know, the H's of food, right? So,
oh, yeah.
got the, you know, hedonic issues, right? And health and whatnot. But I remember I was presenting in a seminar class, and there actually was a study. And I mean, maybe the lab was debunked, and maybe it was out of the Cornell Food Lab. They had some ethical issues there.
Yeah.
But part of it was like, back to the movie and the popcorn was, I need some help, my psychology, man. You just explain what happens in the environment of a lot of our clients, right? They're eating uncontrollably. They're not even aware of that. And I remember one of the studies we had looked at was were they going to eat the popcorn, whether it was fresh or stale?
Mm.
And what they found was essentially, yeah, the popcorn's there, you're going to eat it. So I remember I baited my seminar class. I had made popcorn and I left it out for like 3 days, and I brought it in. I bought nice bags. And I'm like giving a little PowerPoint, and they're just smashing food. And then we get to it, and it was like, you've all been punked. Like,
yeah,
I've been sitting on the awesome table for 4 days, right? But you still ate it. So yeah. I think when you bring up that whole, yeah, the psychology piece, why are they making the decisions that they're making? As a coach, when you hear something like, oh, you know, you're a life coach. Yeah, we naturally, I think, feel that as like a negative connotation. Like, whoa, I'm not all about that. But let's move forward, right? 2021 coming up. Now more than ever, people are going to want more than just somebody who can throw me a workout on an Excel spreadsheet or a training platform. And these are the things that, again, it's change or die. If you don't adapt with the times, you're not going to be of any value to anybody. You're not going to have any services to provide because they're going to want more.
Yeah, I think this, you know, your basic macros and your training program are just going to become a commodity in and of themselves. Right. And, you know, most of the clients I work with, all my clients are awesome, but, you know, there's usually something that was kind of a rate limiter, or they just can't pull a, you know, program off of the shelf, whether it's a weird mechanical issue or something going on. And I mean, that's the time to use the services of a coach, you know, because we all, I think, have to admit we deal with a very biased population too. Right? Huge survivorship bias of people that are seeking you out for a particular thing, who are going to pay you a lot of money. So they are motivated to change. They are motivated, you know, to do those things. That may or may not be kind of the general public running around either, you know? So I think sometimes when we live in the trainer space only, it's easy to kind of look out and go, oh, why are people so, you know, overweight? Why don't they do other things, you know? And they're, like you said, they're, especially now, they're stressed out. They've got a whole bunch of other stuff going on. They're probably doing okay with wherever they're at in their life now. And until something usually drastically changes, it doesn't really rise up and become a priority either. So,
Yeah. And I think just calling that out specifically, that it's just natural for us to say, or just tell ourselves, right, these defeating thoughts and negative self-talk of like, but I used to be able to do this, and it's no excuses now. I've got more time now more than ever, right? Mm-hmm. Let's say pandemic times, right? And I'm in this as a coach or in the industry. I should be doing better, and I'm just going to do it harder, right? Or I need more willpower, right? And these are like all the things that—
Just try harder, bro.
Yeah, that's it, right? Like paleo harder, man. Like,
yep.
That's like an inside joke we have at work. Like, oh, it didn't work. Well, just paleo harder, man, right? And it's not a knock at, you know, the paleo followers out there. But it's, if something's not working, you just can't do it more, do it harder. It's, you've got to develop. And again, back to skill development, right? Everything, for the most part, are skills and they can be learned. But are you putting them in the right sequence? Are you putting them at the right place in time of the coaching conversation? And are you doing the thing before the thing? So all of these elements all intertwine, and it's like, you know what? How about we do, back to the Seinfeld, right? We talk about this all the time, like do the opposite, right? George Costanza.
The George Costanza principle.
Yeah, like my favorite ever. That's like a founding principle of yes. what we try and coach. It's like, you keep doing all of this and your life sucks. George decides to do the opposite. Yeah. Right? He's just like crushing life. So instead of doing it harder, why don't you do it less hard and be more consistent, right? Instead of being so strict and beating yourself up because you were a couple calories or grams over your macros that week and you had to mark yourself non-compliant, why don't we open up a little bit of the freedom there and give yourself a little bit more choices? And, you know, tying all that into it, you brought up like the idea of the coach, but that's a basic psychological need is relatedness, right? So you tie that in with the autonomy for them to choose, establishing tasks and exercises and just challenges for them that they're motivated to accomplish and they're competent doing. You're not putting them out on an island of like, someday you'll get here. No, you're doing something within their stretch limit capacity. And then you actually have them a part of something greater than themselves, like a team, like a coach. You know, the whole idea of accountability really is that come down to coaching. Now more than ever, most of us are craving that. So go get yourself a coach. Coaches get coached all the time.
Oh, yeah.
That's a big difference maker for you.
Yeah. Yeah. Awesome. So as we wrap up here, is there something that surprised you from your research? So like what you thought going in and then where you ended up once you were done? Anything kind of change your mind or things that were unexpected?
Well, that's a great question, Dr. Mike. That's something
I've seen you change your mind about stuff over time. So one of my little grading of people, I guess you could say, is do they ever change their mind, right? And not that you have to be wishy-washy and change your mind all the time, but in the face of new data, are you going to at least consider the data and go, okay, I did consider it. I'm not changing my mind, and here's why. So I always have big respect for people that can at least be open-minded enough to look at it and go, maybe I should do this. Oh, there's some new data now. Okay, yeah, I'm going to go in this direction now instead.
Yeah, no, great question. I'm glad you posed it. So, I actually went into it thinking the strength and conditioning coach was like the person. You are the person that is the best person to do this because of the quality of the relationship. You spend so much time with the athletes. Everything, the respect of the organization, et cetera. So I went in being like, I've got to prove to me and to my committee that like, no, the strength coach, like that, they're the ticket, right? They're the linchpin, whatever it is. And as I started going through it, I had to remember that I was also looking at this, more importantly, from the lens of a sport psychology practitioner. Mm. So whether that's a mental performance coach, a sport and exercise professional, I couldn't just be like Coach Adam or Coach Fight, the strength coach. And what I found was, yes, okay, the coach is an integral part of that piece. However, they don't have the skills. They don't have the knowledge for the most part. And while some might have, and this came up actually as a quote, some might have the ability to perform psychological first aid, they don't have the resources, the time, or the knowledge to essentially, you know, put the tourniquet on. They're not aware of diagnostic interviewing, right? And so now as a sport psychology professional, I'm thinking, okay, instead of trying to put the sports psych people out of a job because a lot of Division I institutions are going to be hiring, whether it's a sports psychologist, a mental performance coach, a psychiatrist, and there's obviously different scopes that you can work with there. How about we start bringing them to the same table and saying, hey, look, I'm a strength coach. I can do some basic first aid here, right? I can work on some arousal regulation methods. I'm working on relaxing. I'm doing RPR and doing breath control, et cetera. But I really love to take it up a notch, and I love to enlist your support. So now as we start getting towards a high-performance model, it's no longer like Joe the strength coach in the basement of the weight room and all of the administrators on the sixth or seventh floor. It's about, can we really put together a high-performance team? Can we get the support of the sports psychology professional? Can that individual or team of individuals help our coaching staff because they are the first – responders. They are the boots on the ground. They're doing all these readiness surveys. Well, do they really know when to poke and prod or to actually alert and kind of sound the siren off, right? So in terms of what I would change, I was like gung-ho of like, yeah, we don't need that. We don't need an athletic trainer. We don't need a physio. Like, strength coach will do it all, right? And, you know, the essence of martyrdom. And I came out being like, look, they're in a great position to do all that stuff, but they're overworked.
Yeah.
They love to learn, but they don't have resources. So guess what? Like, that's research study number three for me, is I want to put together like the strength coach's playbook for sports psych, but work with other sport and exercise psychology professionals to say, you have a market here now. So instead of trying to go directly to the athlete, and if it's a private sector, right, and it's not covered by insurance, you've got issues there, how about you start coaching the coaches? Because now you're going to be able to reach more people. Just like, you know, let's talk RPR.
Yeah.
You're trying to coach coaches, and then they can go do their own thing.
Yeah.
So that's what I learned from it. You know, a little bit more integration with other areas of performance. And let's get all the right people at the right table speaking the same language, because – too many kids fall through the cracks. Too many coaches fall through the cracks. And I think our industry would be a much better if we start opening the doors instead of locking them tight.
Yeah. No, I think that's great. And if any good resources for people who are listening who would want to start in that area until your next study comes out?
Yeah, well, I guess continue to shameless plug for me.
Yeah.
Follow me. I'm trying to build up, now that school's over, trying to build my personal brand as like a strength and sports psychology coach. So I'm trying to do my best and learn from guys like you, Dr. Mike, and establishing a little bit of a brand. But there, I think some of the seminal research was, you know, by Radcliffe, Comfort, and Facette. A lot of that was in JSCR, and organizations like the ASP, Association of Applied Sports Psychology, and just looking at how coaching behaviors have been affected or do affect psychological factors and vice versa. So I think we are going to see a shift. I think we're seeing it a little bit more consistent now more than ever, especially with the impact of mental health and performance during COVID-19. So don't be surprised that, you know, every third or fourth study isn't some time trial to fatigue lab test. It's going to be about communication. It's going to be about proper coaching behaviors. And it's going to be about improving all facets of athlete and client performance rather than a bigger bench, bro. So that's where I'd start.
No, and I think that's awesome. And because I talked to Cal Dietz quite a bit, especially when I was there at the University of Minnesota, and I still talk to him a fair amount. But I'm like, trying to coordinate like these hardcore quantitative studies with elite athletes, good friggin' luck. Right. Because if I went to Cal or I went to you and someone and said, hey, bro, I want to take your elite athletes, at least at a college level, I want them to do this program for 16 weeks. You're going to be like, say what? You want to like hijack all my athletes and do some batshit crazy program for 16 weeks just so you can publish a study? What if your program sucks? Then I have to deal with all these athletes on top of coaching, on top of everything else. It's just really not that feasible, because their job is to get performance out. They don't give a shit if anything gets published. That's not their job. However, a qualitative study, maybe take someone like you or someone else, just drop them into the environment with a question, and maybe they observe. Maybe they do some interviews. Maybe they do some other things where they're not as intrusive, I think, to a lot of the hardcore scientists. That makes them bristle a little bit, because it's not the quantitative, we compared this and that and their squat speed didn't go up, whatever. But I think there's a lot of stuff we can learn from successful environments that then may set up even other more quantitative studies too. But I think right now there just isn't as much known about that entire process as what we would like to believe either.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, you said it earlier, the training's going to suck. Well, at least half the training's got to suck, because you need a control group. Right?
Exactly. So, that's the other part, you know, too.
If I'm going to give you my damn athletes, you better give them intervention, you know,
because
I want them to get better. But yeah, and I think it's important there to look at that. Like, I know you're doing some stuff with, I think, or you were with Dr. Ben House, right? Down in Costa Rica.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. So like things like that, like truly applied, like bro search, like let's get after it. But if you have anybody that's like reaching out, or maybe, I mean, if you're a coach still listening to this, like, don't be afraid of like, look, you're probably doing some great stuff. I'm sure there's somebody in your department that's like itching for a paper that needs, that could use the data that you already have. Right. Like, I had a meeting with one of our grad students, and he put together an incredible KPI performance tracker drop down. I mean, it's like, dude, you need to quit school and sell this. Like, you will make thousands, maybe hundreds. We'll see. Right. Yeah. But, we have so much data. Look for the person that understands it, right? And hey, I'm a coach. I know what it's like. I can still write programs. I'm still coaching, and I can look at the other aspect of that. So yeah, I can be the creep in the corner, taking notes and challenging maybe some of the perceptions and attitudes that are happening. But as coaches, you've got to open up to that. So, you know, let your guard down a little bit. If you truly want to be better and you want to help your athletes be better, open those opportunities up and collaborate with people that can walk the walk and talk the talk.
Yeah. And my last part to the academics, and I'd throw myself somewhat in that bucket too, is if a study doesn't have perfect external validation, but it's never been performed before, unless there's a huge methodological flaw, just publish it. You know, because I'm doing the study with Ben House and Tommy Wood and Ryan, where we had people come into Costa Rica. We had them do the same workout 4 days in a row. We did velocity measurements. And again, watching the study, it was far from perfect. There's no question on that. However, so far, yeah, the study could be written a little bit better. We're working on it. But, you know, some of the standard journals were just like completely uninterested. And I'm like, but wait a minute, like, this is a good question, right? Can you do the same thing 4 days in a row? And what happens, right? Mm-hmm. There's just not much data on that. I thought it was a pretty novel question, you know? So I think it has to kind of go both directions too. And not everything is going to have absolute perfect internal validated data and blood levels and everything else either. Those are great. That's awesome. But then again, it's like, are we doing the internal versus external validation on it? So.
Yeah. Well, that's for the researcher to decide. And,
yeah,
you know, we're all going to have our own biases and preferences. But at the end of the day, it's like, hey, that's great. But, you know, I think James Heather says, like, well, if it happens in mice and I can't actually take that and do it or apply it appropriately with my training population, then how much can I really take from it? So
yeah.
I'm all about, at the end of the day, how is this going to help? How is this applicable to what I do on a day-to-day basis? And if I can't take it from those research findings, then I'm on to the next one.
Yeah. Yeah. And I apologize that you know Mr. Heathers. No, I'm just giving him bad
time. Oh, actually, I love that dude. I don't personally, but his name gets thrown around quite a bit in some of the circles I frequent in the Twitterverse. So
yeah.
I do know that he does have an account there. And yeah, that's great, but it was found in mice. So stop saying we can just roll that over into a human.
Yeah, totally agree. Awesome. So where can people find more about you on the old interwebs?
I'm going to doing a little bit better job, hopefully, with social, but pretty active on Facebook, like yourself. So some spots left there to connect. And then I guess Instagram would be AE Fight. So AEFEIT. Twitter, Adam_Fight. But also my personal email, AEFight@gmail.com. So I have some open office hours like you, Dr. Mike.
Nice.
I took a picture from your playbook.
Yeah, yeah.
So whoever just wants to connect and chat, I'm like my puppy, man. I just love seeing and talking to people now because it's not really happening a lot too much. So reach out. Love to talk shop. And if I can do anything or just connect, I would love to hear from you.
Yeah, and thank you so much. And hopefully we'll get to maybe hang out again in person. It's been a while. I think the last time I saw you was in Toronto when I crashed the Precision Nutrition potluck.
Yeah, that was a great time. I think, if we make it back up there, we're going to be crashing a lot of places and people there. So it'll be good to reconnect and hopefully get that level 3 someday.
Yeah, awesome. Well, thank you so much for all your time and sharing all your knowledge. I really appreciate it. And I'm super stoked to see all the great stuff that you have coming out yet too. So thank you for all your contributions.
We're just beginning, so I appreciate it, Dr. Mike. Thank you.
Awesome. Thank you so much. Thank you so much for listening to the podcast and that wonderful chat I had with now Dr. Adam. Super great to catch up with him again as we kind of wandered all over the map there with various topics. Be sure to check out his stuff coming out in the future. I know he's going to have a lot more great information, and I really enjoyed our conversation, and it's very cool to talk to people who have done both high-level academics and who have been, you know, in the trenches, both lifting themselves and coaching for many years, too, as we try to bridge the gap between those two universes. And speaking of bridging the gap, check out the Flex Diet certification. Go to flexdiet.com, FlexDiet.com. And that was one of my goals when I designed the certification, is how do we bridge the world of what we know about academics and research related to nutrition and recovery, and how do we put that into a practical system that you can use where you understand the context, You understand the intervention. And then we even break down the 5 specific action items that you would use with a client, all within a flexible approach. So go to flexdiet.com, FlexDiet.com. Get on the wait list there, and you will be notified as soon as it opens again, in addition to lots of daily content there via the newsletter. Thank you so much. If you enjoyed this, or even if you didn't, still leave me a review, leave me some feedback, anything I can do to make the podcast better, I would appreciate it. And if you've enjoyed listening to it, I would appreciate knowing that also. Thank you so much. Have a great day. Talk to you next time.